Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Tumblr, beginning next week, will ban so-called adult content from its microblogging site. That's a decision that came about after Tumblr was banned from the Apple App Store because of child pornography. Tumblr fans are disappointed for two reasons. They don't want pornography banned, and they don't like the artificial intelligence tool being used to flag violators of the new rules. Wired staff writer Louise Matsakis has been covering the issue. She joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So tell us more about why this ban came about in the first place.
So I think there are a couple of reasons. First of all, it's really hard to put porn next to ads, right? Tumblr has been a struggling platform for a number of years. And unlike Facebook and YouTube and these other platforms that have made a lot of money via targeted advertising, they don't allow adult content. And Tumblr, you know, kind of since the beginning, has always been a space for DIY pornography and other forms of adult content, which is really hard to sell ads against. Also, in the last couple of months, it's kind of come to light that Tumblr has struggled with child pornography on its platform, and they were recently removed from the Apple iOS store because of that issue. So they were really not doing a good job of policing their platform, and they're also struggling financially to kind of sell advertisements.
And I mean, the users, is it a big problem? Is pornography a big part of Tumblr or what?
So yes and no. I think it is a large part of kind of the community. A lot of people on Tumblr either interacted with this content in some way. It was not necessarily, you know, the main reason that they were using the platform. Only about 1% of Tumblr users actually generate adult content, but about 25% or so interact or see adult content when they use the platform. So it's not a huge part, but, you know, it's a much bigger part than a platform like Facebook where there's no adult content at all.
So those numbers just tell me that the 1%, that they're going to lose the 1% who produce it, that's not a big problem for Tumblr. They need to do something about it. From a business point of view, the software is another issue. It's making mistakes. How so?
Yeah, so last week it kind of came to light that when they kind of implemented the software to remove the adult content, it was removing all sorts of stuff. Pictures of chickens, cartoons, design patents, kind of anything you can imagine was accidentally getting flagged. And that's probably a result of the AI that they're using being poorly trained. It's going to learn and get better over time, but immediately it just kind of caused this chaos where lots of people who post, you know, art that they write or, you know, even pictures of Joe Biden or... we're getting flagged as being adult, even when they clearly were not.
We're talking about Tumblr's decision to ban pornography on the microblogging site and also the troubles Tumblr's having so far with its AI in flagging that pornography. My guest is Louise Matsakis. She's a Wired staff writer who has been covering this issue. Are you a Tumblr user? Do you follow Tumblr? Are you frustrated? What do you think about the number one, the rule change, and number two, how they're implementing it? 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So the machine is learning. The software is supposed to get better with time. Isn't there some kind of AI software out there that's been ramped up to identify what's pornography?
Yeah, I mean, so Facebook and a lot of other platforms have gotten really good at identifying pornography. You know, I'm sure a lot of your listeners use Facebook and they've probably never seen, you know, hardcore pornography on the platform because
right.
Their AI tools are really good at it. But those are proprietary tools that they're not selling or sharing with a company like Tumblr. So they're having a hard time, you know, building their own sort of software. I also think, you know, there's some philosophical issues that I think an AI really can't detect, even if super good at it. For example, Tumblr has said that they're going to ban female presenting nipples. You know, what does that mean? When does a nipple become female presenting or
right.
not? You know, there are kind of questions that I don't even think a computer can answer, really.
Why are they picking on female nipples?
I think, again, it has to do with what advertisers want to be near. You know, if it's a picture of a guy at the beach, I think that, you know, a Fortune 500 company would be fine with their ad running next to that. But if it's a picture of a topless woman, I think that there, you know, that presents other sorts of issues. There are also problems, you know, where is the line between art and something that's, you know, intended
yeah.
to be pornography? There are going to be a lot of problems that Tumblr is going to have to kind of grapple with that a lot of other social platforms have faced in the past.
And how are Tumblr users responding to this?
So I think a lot of them are really sad. I think what's different about Tumblr that a lot of people who don't use the platform might not know is that it's predominantly used by women. So this was a really sex positive, really expressive place for young women in particular to learn about their sexuality. So I think a lot of people are kind of mourning that because unlike a lot of parts of the internet, which are really, you know, geared towards heterosexual men, Tumblr was a place where women in particular could learn about their sexuality. And I think they're really sad that they're losing that because it was such a unique opportunity and such a unique place for, I personally learned about my own sexuality as a young girl using Tumblr. So I'm sad that other young girls won't have that opportunity.
You know, and that makes sense. And I hear what you're saying. So I'm kind of wondering, who are they marketing Tumblr to? Or are there ways to silo that? Or does that go against the whole larger world of Tumblr to be siloing stuff like that?
So they have tried that in the past. They instituted this thing called Safe Mode, which, you know, only if you verified that you were over 18 could you actually see any of this content. And you couldn't see it directly from Google. So if, you know, you Googled Tumblr adult content, you wouldn't be able to see that without signing in. So they did kind of try that, but I guess it didn't work. And that does work for some other platforms. For example, Twitter allows adult content, but they kind of blur it unless you, you know, seek it out and click on it and want to see that content. They, you know, they hide it in some search results or it's not as visible. So some platforms have tried to balance having both. Mm-hmm. But I think Tumblr kind of just decided they tried that and they're just going to put a hard line in where they are not going to allow it at all.
And then the issue, I mean, there are pornographic magazines out there that get and online sites that get plenty of advertising. Can't they control where the ads go? So use the AI to seek the pornographic material and then target the ads to that fit there.
So again, that's really, that requires really sophisticated technology. And for whatever reason, Tumblr doesn't have it right now. What I kind of wrote about in my article about this is that I think, you know, learning a little bit about Tumblr's history might explain why they don't have that technology. You know, mm-hmm. They've been acquired twice in the last 5 years. They were first acquired by Yahoo, and then Yahoo was bought by Verizon. So they've kind of switched hands a lot, unlike Facebook, who's had the same CEO the whole time. Unlike YouTube, which is owned by Google, mm-hmm. they've kind of, you know, struggled in a way that these other platforms haven't because they've been trading owners. It is really difficult when you don't have, you know, a dedicated engineering team that's been there the whole time and building this technology the whole time. Also, Facebook, you know, hasn't allowed pornography for, you know, a decade. So they have so much data, so much experience they can work with, whereas Tumblr is just kind of stumbling into this now. So it's really going to take time. And they're going to have to, you know, figure out where their own lines are.
How do you train AI to do anything? What can we learn about that right now to explain why this is so difficult?
So let's take an example of an AI that you want to learn to identify when it sees a cat. You know, a young child, you can show them two cats and they understand what a cat is. An AI is not that smart. So what they need to do is they need to see millions of pictures of cats in all sorts of circumstances. They need to see cats rolling in the grass. They need to see cats on trees. They need to see all different kinds of breeds of cats. And then once they have viewed those pictures, they're able to then see a new photo and see if it matches what they've learned about cats in the past. But they're still going to make mistakes. Like, you know, they might mistake a lion or they might mistake a dog that has pointy ears in a way that a human wouldn't because they're really just looking at it pixel by pixel and seeing, do those pixels match what I've seen in the past? A lot of AI right now struggles with situations that are unlike anything they've seen in the past, whereas even if I haven't seen, you know, the cat on my block before, I know it's a cat. You know, they're humans don't see the same way that an AI does, even though it's tempting to make that comparison. It's much more mechanic. They're learning much more slowly. So what's happening with Tumblr right now is that their AI probably has not seen enough examples of adult content and not adult content. And that's a really hard one, right? A cat's pretty easy, but, you know, there's adult cartoons, there's, you know, adult objects, there's, you know, just regular porn. There's a lot of different kinds of adult content. And it's probably getting confused about what is and isn't adult content.
Does this change? I mean, what's Tumblr asking its followers to do at this point? Hang with us. We're working on this. And bye to everybody else who wants to get into porn. It's just not going to be the place to go anymore.
Yeah, they're just basically saying, you know, we decided that this is not, we don't want to be the community for sharing this kind of content anymore, and we're sorry. And basically until December 17th, what they're saying is that we're not going to delete anything. We're not going to take it off our platform. But, you know, you basically have until then, and then we're going to make it private. So if you had an adult content blog and we flagged it, you know, starting December 17th, it's going to be only viewable to you. So they're not going to erase anyone's data, but you're not going to be able to share it on Tumblr anymore. You're not going to be able to gain a following sharing that kind of content anymore. And I think there's a lot of anxiety about what could get caught up in that, right? Not just, you know, a innocuous cartoon, but for example, LGBTQ content or, you know, content that's designed to teach people about sexual safety and about, you know, STDs or that sort of thing, or sexual education. I think there's a lot of anxiety now about what will get swept up into that, and where it's really unclear where the lines are going to be. But, you know, Tumblr has been struggling for a long time. So I think a lot of users kind of see this as the last nail in the coffin. And it's really sad because it was such a unique place that, you know, your aunt and your, you know, your sisters and your, all your high school friends might be on Facebook, and that's kind of where you show, you know, your most polished self. But Tumblr was kind of where a lot of people could express themselves, share their art. It was a much more expressive platform. And I think that's what's really depressing a lot of people right now, is that a big part of that was being able to share adult content.
What kind of appeal process, or is there no appeal process for this? Is there anywhere people who have had their material privatized that don't warrant it can go?
Yeah, so if your post was flagged, you can appeal, and Tumblr says that that appeal will be viewed by a real live human as opposed to the AI. And then if your appeal is approved, you know, the post will be marked fine. And they're starting to go through that right now. I've heard from some people who got their innocuous post flagged that they've been unflagged. So there is kind of an appeals process, but it's going to take time. And I think even after the ban goes fully into effect, we'll see a lot of false positives. You know, I'm sure there's going to be instances of like people in bathing suits or, you know, naked statues, that sort of thing, that's going to get caught up in this, even when it's not supposed to. It's going to take a while. And it's also going to be, like I said, you know, more than just training the AI. It's also going to be Tumblr staff answering more philosophical questions about, you know, when does something constitute art? When is something actually pornographic? When do we want to have it on our platform and when do we not? This is a really big change for them. And I think it's going to be hard. I don't think it's going to be really difficult.
And do you think it can survive? Have others fallen where Tumblr's going?
Yeah, so I think the biggest comparison a lot of people are making is LiveJournal, which in the early 2000s also banned adult content. Actually, that pushed a lot of people to Tumblr, interestingly. And a lot of users on Tumblr are talking about Pillowfort, which is a new social network. They're thinking about going there, or other sorts of blogs that they can start. So I think a lot of people are thinking about an exodus. But on the other hand, you know, without adult content, I do think this will be more appealing to advertisers. They're part of Verizon, which is a huge telecommunications company with a lot of resources. You know, it's possible that this will help them gain more advertising revenue, but I don't think it will be good for them, you know, attracting users, because that was a really big thing for attracting a lot of people, that they could post whatever they wanted. And that was a big draw. And I think without that, I don't know if they're going to get more users, but they might get more advertising, which is what they really need.
And as far as more users, do you think that the demographics of the users will change?
I don't think so. I think most of the people who are on Tumblr right now have been using it for a long time, and a lot of them are not going to go anywhere because they use it to share their, you know, their portfolio, or they use it to blog. And, you know, if you already have an established presence there, you're probably not going to go anywhere unless you were an adult content creator. But I don't think a lot of the younger kids there are really using it. They're using more mobile-friendly social networks like Instagram or Snapchat that are, you know, better suited to their mobile device, whereas Tumblr was really something a lot of people like to use on their desktop.
Well, Louise Matsakis, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having us.
Louise Matsakis is a Wired staff writer. She's been covering the issue of Tumblr and pornography and how it's trying to weed out the porn to attract more advertisers. Coming up, we are going to talk about social media and depression. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Social media and depression. There's a connection, according to a new research out of the University of Pennsylvania. Jordan Young is co-author of the study. She joins us by phone. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
What was the hypothesis of your study? What were you looking for?
So we were trying to see if social media was actually causing any kind of changes in well-being for its users. So we were trying to basically prove some of the hypotheses that have been out there in some of the news sources. And what we found is that if you decrease your social media use, you actually experience a decrease in loneliness and depression, which was really interesting for us to find.
How is the, well, first of all, what, I mean, there was just a lot of anecdotal evidence out there at that point.
So, yeah, a lot of the prior research that we had come across in our literature review indicated that there was some kind of a relationship between decreased well-being and social media use, but it was all correlational or associations, meaning that we can say, okay, you're more likely to be more depressed if you use social media. But there was nothing to actually say that social media was causing that decline in depression. So, that increase in depression. So that's what we were trying to prove.
Versus depressed people just use social media more.
Exactly. Instead of just being able to say, okay, we observe these two phenomena occurring, but we don't actually know if one is really impacting the other. Now we can say that social media is having a causal impact.
You know, I was listening to something the other day on NPR about how people's behavior change when they know that they're being watched, you know, particularly relating to technology. How did you conduct the study?
So, yeah, what you're referring to, the self-monitoring effect, that's definitely something that we were trying to take into account. And we tried to design our study in a way to control for that, where we actually had a baseline period at the beginning of the study where participants were being monitored for their usage, but we weren't asking them to change anything yet. So we could establish more of a, I guess, a baseline of what is normal when they are being monitored.
And how did you conduct the study? How did it work?
So we recruited participants from the University of Pennsylvania. They were all undergraduate students. And we asked them to participate in that week of baseline observation, where basically they would just use social media as usual, and then they would fill out a questionnaire that we created with a battery of clinically validated well-being measures. And then after that first week, we assigned them to one of two groups. We had our control group, which is basically told to just use social media as usual, don't make any changes, and continue to fill out the survey and send us their screenshots of their objective usage over the next 3 weeks. And then we had the experimental group, and they were told that they had to limit themselves to at most 10 minutes per day per social media platform. And we were defining social media as Facebook, Instagram, and Snapchat. So those participants were essentially limited to at most 30 minutes of social media use per day for that next 3 weeks. And then they filled out the same survey with the well-being questionnaires and also sent us their screenshots so we could actually make sure that they were sticking to that 10-minute limit.
What did the screenshots show? I don't quite understand how that works.
Oh, so a lot of the previous research relied on self-report data, meaning that you would ask a participant, how much time do you think you spent on social media yesterday, for example? And that may or may not be accurate. Some people might just recall things incorrectly, or they might not necessarily remember using it the full amount of time. So what we tried to do that hadn't been done in previous research is we actually had our participants send us screenshots of their battery usage on their phone. There's a function on the iPhone where you can see how much screen time you have on each application.
Okay.
So that way we actually have objective numbers of how much time they spent on each application, and we were able to make more accurate judgments.
And, you know, I mean, couldn't they have gone on their computer and done the same thing?
So theoretically, that is one of the issues that we had considered. We think that that may have been an issue with Facebook if people used it on their computers a lot. Mm-hmm. But Instagram and Snapchat, those are primarily mobile applications, so we didn't think it was as much of an issue there. But that is something that warrants future research.
Hmm. And how much can you extrapolate the results to social media on a larger scale? I'm thinking of Twitter.
Right. So, yeah, I think that this is the first step in proving that causal connection of saying that social media is bad for our well-being, essentially. And I think that there could be a lot of future studies looking at a variety of different social media platforms. We're actually right now conducting a follow-up looking at dating application usage as a variety of social media. So we're really interested to see what those results come out to be.
Yeah, because some people get just hooked on checking the dating sites, right?
Oh, exactly. Yes. And we're sure the again, the prior literature has indicated some kind of a relationship with self-esteem, but there's nothing to actually say that using these applications is what's causing that. So that's what we're trying to prove.
And the 10 minutes thing, limiting it to 10 minutes a day. First of all, what's typical? What was typical? How much was that changing their lifestyle?
So, well, a big question that we usually get is why did we pick 10 minutes as opposed to just saying don't use social media at all? And honestly, we thought it was pretty much going to be impossible to ask our participants to not use social media because they use it for a variety of things. You know, that especially this is an undergraduate student population. Maybe they use it to advertise for an event that their club is hosting. Maybe they're using it to talk to their friends from abroad. So we honestly just didn't think it would be representative of actual usage if we were to tell them just not to use it at all because social media is such an integral part of our daily lives. So we just kind of asked people on campus to try to determine what the most appropriate amount of time would be and also did a little bit of research. And it seemed that 10 minutes was going to be a sweet spot so that people would have enough time to do what they needed to do, but not too much time where they might not get sucked in and have more of those negative consequences.
And how for how long were they supposed to do this? For how many weeks?
So they had that 1 week of baseline monitoring, and then they had 3 weeks of this intervention. So they were limited for 3 weeks.
How do you quantify what you found? Tell us.
So what we were able to observe is that the participants who were told to limit their social media use, meaning they were using it most 30 minutes per day, they experienced a decrease in depression and loneliness that was both clinically and statistically significant, meaning that basically from the beginning of the study to the end of the study, they were feeling better about themselves, they were feeling more connected to the people around them, and they were just happier overall.
And what do you speculate or what do you hypothesize is the reason for that? What exactly, what are you thinking might be about social media that disconnects people because it's social media?
Right. So there's a lot of different factors that we think might be at play. One big aspect of it is that a lot of times when you go on social media, you engage in a downward social comparison, meaning that you see the way people represent their lives on social media. Sometimes it's not completely accurate. They might only choose the good parts that they want to highlight. And then you start to compare yourself to that, and that can conjure some negative feelings. But then on the flip side of that, every minute that you spend on social media is a minute that you're not interacting with the real world and you're not interacting with the people around you and being mindful and in the moment. So that could also have something to do with it because time is essentially a zero-sum game. So you can't get that time back with spending it with the people around you.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about a study out of the University of... Sorry, I've just forgotten the name of the university, out of the University of Pennsylvania that looks at the relationship between depression and social media. My guest is Jordan Young. She's a co-author of the study. If you have a question or comment or have your own experience to share with social media and depression, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Depression and anxiety are all often connected anyways. How did you try to suss out the anxiety piece of that?
Yeah, so in the survey that I had mentioned that we sent to our participants, we tried to include as many measures as we could of aspects of well-being. So we had depression and loneliness, as I mentioned. We did measure anxiety. We also measured self-esteem. And we actually had a scale for fear of missing out, or FOMO.
I'm sorry, what was it? Oh, fear of missing out. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so it's FOMO, basically, to try to see if there was any kind of a change. And we did notice overall that participants' well-being, when they were told to limit their usage, was improved at the end of the study. The most significant ones were definitely depression and loneliness, but we did see an improvement in anxiety as well.
That fear of missing out, was there a trajectory at first when they weren't on social media? Did you see an uptick at all in anxiety or depression?
We were actually expecting to find that, and we did. There was very minimally. We did think that people were going to start feeling a little bit anxious and maybe a little bit more FOMO, actually, because they couldn't be constantly connected to their friends. But one thing that we actually found that was very interesting is at the end of the study, we let our participants give us some feedback, just a free response question of how did you feel doing this study? Did you observe anything different about your behavior? And a lot of them commented that at first they were a little bit apprehensive to have to limit their social media usage in order to stay in the study. But in the end, what they found is that they were so happy that they did it because they felt much more connected to the people around them, and they just felt like they were much more in the moment and overall enjoying what they were doing.
Did you get any feedback from the people who were the control group?
Yes, we did. We asked both groups.
And what did they say?
They said that it was definitely interesting for them to have to monitor their usage over this time, and it made some of them realize how much time they actually spend on social media, which mm-hmm. is definitely interesting. So both groups did have some benefit from being in the study, which we were very happy about. And again, we were able to control, though, for those differences with them self-monitoring with their usage with that initial baseline period at first. So we weren't worried about it affecting our results per se, but we were happy that they were able to have some benefits as well.
I would love to see if there is any brain differences.
Oh, that, I think that that's definitely a future study that's on the horizon. I think that there can be very interesting things to observe there, yes.
The age group that you used is already pretty high anxiety. They're in college and they're going to the University of Pennsylvania. It's no, you can't be too much of a shirker and go there. So what about other age groups? What about other demographics?
So that's definitely something that needs to be conducted in a follow-up study. As we mentioned, this is the first study of its kind, so we were able to use this demographic at the University of Pennsylvania because this is also the primary user demographic of people on these applications. But we think that there might be some qualitative differences between different age groups. Maybe there's a difference with older generations who just simply didn't grow up with this technology, so maybe it has a different impact on them. Or for younger generations where this technology existed before they were even born, then maybe it has a stronger impact on them. We can't say for sure, but we can definitely speculate.
Well, Jordan Young, I want to thank you for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Jordan Young is co-author of a study that showed not just a correlation, but a causation between the use of social media and depression and anxiety out of the University of Pennsylvania. We're going to have more Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's time to think about holiday tech gifts for the adults in your life. Joining us for a third segment in this series on tech holiday gifts, Android Central contributing editor Russell Holly. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So how do you define adult gifts?
Oh, mostly it's just the stuff that I like, I think.
So we have a variety of price ranges here and so forth.
Oh, yeah. This is something that, you know, really kind of anybody who digs kind of the shiny things, and it's you know, as wide a group as you can get for that kind of thing without being terribly expensive in either way.
Okay. And just before we get started, I just want to tell listeners, if you have a question about something, you're thinking about getting somebody in your life of any age, today's the time to call in and ask Russell Holly your question. He might have some ideas for you. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You wanted to talk about some new phones from Samsung, the S9 and the S9 Plus. What's the difference from the last edition?
No, these are the phones that came out earlier this year, and they continue to be kind of the standalone phone that I end up recommending to people when they ask what kind of phone they should get this year. And it's kind of interesting that we are now at the end of the year, and this is still the phone that I end up recommending to so many people because Samsung did just a really good job with those phones this year. The cameras on them are exceptional. They feel really nice. There's two different sizes so that people who prefer larger phones have an option. People who prefer smaller phones have an option. And really, it's just a great kind of all-around phone that ends up being the thing that I recommend to most people. And because it's been out for as long as it has, I say that, you know, it's only been out for 7 or 8 months.
Yeah, I know. I always have to check you.
But because it's been out for 7 or 8 months, the price has already come down pretty considerably for a lot of places that you would go to buy these. So they end up being considerably less expensive than, say, the most recent iPhone or something from Google's Pixel line or something like that.
Is this a good choice for somebody, who wants to move up from the S8? Is it that big of a difference?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the big thing here is, there's a noticeable performance difference. The software updates that this gets are arriving faster than you would get on the S8 just because the phone isn't quite as old. This is something that I would Samsung's going to have to work really hard in order for me to recommend, whatever they end up announcing next, just because what this offers is still a very good experience.
And you're saying the price has been dipping. Where is it at right now?
In a lot of cases, you can get this starting between $600 and $700 in a lot of places, especially if you walk into a carrier store. This is the phone that typically gets offered for things like buy one, get one free promotions, or if you're just getting one for yourself, then you can usually get it for a pretty substantial discount.
I remember the first smartphone I ever received was as a gift, and ever since then, I just think of it's an entitlement almost.
a lot of people do.
They don't think of phones as gifts anymore.
No, it ends up, it's gifts depending on, I guess, the kind of person. My sister, for example, is the kind of person who doesn't usually go out and buy new tech for herself. I see her using something that is broken and terrible, and for Christmas I go, please stop using that thing. Here's this thing that is better. Whereas, my younger brothers, for example, when Verizon hits them up and says, your 2-year contract is over, do you want to upgrade? Then they go immediately the next day and go and upgrade. So, everyone's a little different there. But, yeah, for people who maybe don't know to go and grab something for themselves, that's a viable option.
What about someone switching from Apple to Android? Is that something a choice you make for somebody, or is that something you wait and maybe let them decide on? Kind of like buying a puppy.
It's something I usually talk to people about first, and it depends a lot on how deeply embedded they are in either ecosystem. Like if you enjoy using a MacBook and if you enjoy using an iPad and your iPhone is in need of upgrades, then the iPhone is probably where you would want to go next because that integration with that ecosystem is still really great. But if you're using other stuff, then the list of viable options increases pretty considerably because that integration isn't really a factor for you.
Okay. You wanted to talk about the Mac Mini. This is an updated processor from Apple.
This is actually a really big deal. This is something that I got unreasonably excited about because let's say 10 years ago now, I really enjoyed using the Mac Mini line. It was this super, super small computer that you could use on a desk. It took up very little space, and it gave you pretty much the same experience that you would get to a kind of a mid-range desktop computer. Mm-hmm. And so as kind of like the home computer or the office computer, it was something that I found I really appreciated. Apple has not updated this in a really long time until this year, where they updated not only the inside, but the outside. They made it smaller, and they made it with a lot, kind of newer hardware and things like that. And this kind of brought me back to that experience that I had a long time ago, where this was the computer that I would prefer to use, on my desk at home, because it just takes up way less space. It's the kind of thing that I would recommend to someone who needs a little more than a laptop when it comes to screen size and stuff like that, but still has pretty limited space needs, say for a college dorm or for just a smaller apartment. This kind of ends up being a great, just kind of everybody computer, and depending on how you get it spec'd out, they can be pretty reasonably priced.
How small is it? How small was it, and how small is it, is the new version?
It used to be something that I could pretty comfortably fit in a backpack and have lots of room for other stuff. Mm-hmm. Not as wide as a laptop or anything like that, but the current version is something that I can very nearly fit in the palm of my hand. It hangs off of my fingertips a bit. And it's a little thicker than, say, one of the bigger Harry Potter books, but it's a smaller, computer. It's something that you can, in many cases, there have been, for the previous versions of this, there were custom brackets that you could get that actually mounted the computer on the back of your monitor so that it just disappeared entirely.
Now, they upgraded the storage space and speed, but they also increased the price, right?
Well, sure. I mean, they're using, you know, brand new hardware, and they're using technology that wasn't available to this this design originally. So they've kind of increased that pretty considerably. But the price has only gone up by about $200. And when you consider the increase in hardware, it's actually pretty reasonable. You're still looking at starting at around $800 for this computer. And if you are replacing a desktop and you already have things like the mouse and the keyboard and the monitor and things like that that you would want to connect to this anyway. But you have a lot of flexibility there.
Any downfalls, any cautionary notes?
Well, it's a small computer and it's not designed to be upgraded, particularly easily. You know, so what you're buying is the experience that you're going to have, and it's limited by its size. You know, so if you want to do things like set up a virtual reality machine or something like that, then you would need other accessories that connected to it, and that could get pretty expensive. Whereas a traditional desktop, you could have all of those things kind of built into one box. So you are taking the same kind of drawbacks that you would to any small computer or laptop, in that the resources are pretty much what you get when you buy it.
And, you know, as you mentioned, it took 4 years for Apple to update this. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think Apple was not entirely convinced that the audience was there. You know, the big push to portability for a lot of people meant that MacBooks and iPads were pretty much the way that their audience was going. And so there was a waiting period to see if there was still some excitement for these kind of tiny computers. And this has been out for just a couple weeks now, and it's actually kind of hard to find one in the Apple stores in my area. So, there's anecdotal evidence there, but I think it's actually been pretty successful since its relaunch.
You wanted to talk about the Xbox Game Pass. This is a retro game?
No, so Xbox Game Pass is actually a subscription service, and I found myself really liking this more than classic console reboots that have happened. You know, the NES Classic and the PlayStation Classic that came out this year. The big deal with those is that you get this kind of nostalgia kick where you plug this little version of an old game console in, and you get, 20 games that you can play from your teen years or your childhood. And that's a cool thing, but you're spending $130 sometimes dollars on these things that I think for a lot of people are going to end up collecting dust in a couple weeks after you realize that there are only so many times you can play through Super Mario Bros. 3 before you're tired of it. I found that, for people who aren't, really, really hooked on some of these older games, but kind of like thumbing through and remembering, the Xbox Game Pass service is a monthly subscription service that gives you access to just hundreds of games from, all the way back to the original Xbox, including, the original Halo and things like that. And that just felt to me like a much better deal, and the kind of thing that I actually already have. Purchased several subscriptions to give as gifts this year instead of, kind of the classic console.
How much do they cost?
They start at $9 a month, and you can get very much like Xbox Live. You can kind of pre-purchase multiple months. Xbox is constantly adding new titles to it and making the titles, kind of available across all of the Xbox experiences. So it can be stuff that came out on the original Xbox. It can be stuff that came out on the Xbox 360. There's a lot of stuff that they have been doing for this, and it just felt like a better deal to me.
What's your favorite? What are you doing now with it?
Oh, I'm kind of a sucker for the Halo games.
Okay.
Playing through is something that I did with my friends as a teenager. So it's a lot of fun to go back and do that. But also, the original Xbox 360 game is Perfect Dark Zero, which is a kind of like a James Bond-esque kind of run through and be sneaky game that I really liked.
Okay, and are they they're all the classic games? You're saying there are hundreds of them. I don't think of hundreds as being classic, but. What do you mean by that? Well, I guess, I probably have a very limited bandwidth for what's classic on this kind of a thing. But do they update the games?
There are some that get updated to kind of higher resolution formats. The Halo series, for example, was updated to kind of modern day graphics. But most of these are you know, they look as they did 15 years ago.
Okay. For the nostalgia freaks in the world and people who like to play old games without having to buy the old games. You wanted to talk about gloves. It's not a tech device, but you're recommending touchscreen gloves. Is it Mujo or Mujo gloves?
Mujo, yeah. Mujo. These are gloves. You know, I kind of go through this trouble every time the weather gets cold and finding gloves that are comfortable enough to wear, but also keep my hands warm and let me play with my phone, because I am 33 and don't know how to put my phone down, even when I'm walking down an icy sidewalk. And these really did a very good job. They're insulated fleece gloves. They actually kept my hands warm when it was 24 degrees earlier this week in Maryland. And I was actually able to very comfortably pick my phone up and use it and not have any problems with, kind of missed button presses where I'm tapping in one place, but it's registering on the other, which is a lot of problems I have with gloves. And so I have a lot of family members who also, try to use their phone when they're kind of out doing something when it gets colder. And so I picked up several pairs of these to give as gifts this year, because they just seem like the best of the experiences that I've had so far with these kinds of gloves.
And how much are they?
They start at 45.
Okay, so that's
for 1 cent.
Cheap.
They're not. You know, these are kind of nicer gloves. They're designed to last a while. They're something that you're not going to kind of shove into a pocket. But in my defense, I've spent a lot of time with $15 and $20 gloves that have fallen apart very quickly. So I kind of felt like I needed to step up if it was going to survive me. And maybe that's just a problem with me. Maybe I should just put my phone in my pocket and stop messing around when it's cold.
I think you're onto something. I think it's nice that you think of all of your family that way. I wanted to just review with you again, like what your top choices were for the little kids and medium-sized kids too. Can you go back and refresh our memory?
Yeah. So, I mean, the biggest thing for teens, if you're looking to have fun with them, there's just a really neat little robot called Anki Vector that you can set up to patrol a desk or kind of a bedroom floor and protect your area. It has some basic facial recognition stuff that it'll say the name of the person it recognizes, and it has the Amazon Alexa service built into it for some kind of basic smart home control. Mm-hmm. My son is just a junkie for talking to this little robot to do things like controlling the lights in his bedroom. And then for younger people, I found that I was really happy with some of the kind of learn to program tools that were on the web, but it was kind of hard to keep someone using that without help over an extended period of time. And the Kano company made this coding kit using the Harry Potter company. And there's a wand that you can actually buy, and the kid assembles the wand, and they can use that to kind of swing the wand at a computer or an iPad, and build kind of programming tools around that. It's a really it's another layer of interactivity for teaching kids how to program that I thought was really just a lot of fun.
And teaching kids how to program, it's sort of a basic, I don't like to use survival skill, but it's something that they not necessarily have to do, but have to understand going forward.
I think it's super important that more people understand how computers work. We have a pretty serious problem with that moving forward.
Why do you think?
Because the closer we get to things just being magic, the harder it is to explain how things like data breaches work.
Hmm. It's kind of like knowing how to fix your car, knowing how it works.
In a way, yeah. The problem, I think the only difficulty with that analogy is that your car, doesn't know what your social security number is.
Well, yeah, exactly. And now even cars, I mean, they're just big computers themselves.
Yeah, that's true. And a lot of them are, we're getting to a point where a lot of cars are connecting directly to phones to interact with those apps so that you have them in kind of a safer space on a larger screen. I think those are really important.
See, Russell, how do people buy for you? Do you get socks and sweaters and stuff for Christmas? Do they just...
No, it ends up being really easy, actually, because I already have kind of all the gadgety stuff handled, I really like just going out and doing stuff. So, like, my partner knows that the coolest thing for me is a weekend where we go to a place that we've never been before and you know, just do dinner in places that we've never done, you know, things like that before. So, for me, that's really easy, but it's also very gadget-free. My holidays are typically very gadget-free.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you recommend for people who want to do things as families when it comes to technology?
I mean, the biggest thing for fun, is to look into things like the Nintendo Switch, which is one of the few things that is built purposely for, you know, getting together and doing things as a group instead of kind of one-on-one. Things like Mario Party make it really easy to play with groups of people.
Mm-hmm.
And then, really when it comes to group activities, it's really varied. So it's hard for me to make any solid recommendations outside of just entertainment.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for all your ideas this season. Russell does this for us every year. He kind of does a shopping list for people, for young children, older children, and adults. And you can check those out. Go to the links on our website for our previous shows on this topic. Been doing it for, pardon me, the last 3 weeks. And Russell Holly, I want to thank you as always for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Russell Holly, Android Central contributing editor. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook. Follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me on Twitter, too, at Ann Fisher, WOSU. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Mary Lee Williams, assistant producer Kyle McKinnon, All Sides interns Martin Coleman, Kaylin Martin, Maisie Glockner, and Ray Brewster, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks a lot for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.